Hi, you're listening to Screen of the Crime. I'm Maggie, and this is a podcast where we talk about true crime, what would happen if your favorite TV and movie characters committed those crimes. Today we have a guest. Introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Alia Payne, and I'm Maggie's friend from the sixth grade. She rescued my ass from a massive beating in gym.
Sure. What have you been up to?
Quarantining at home with my parents in Florida.
Woo.
Yay. Yeah, right.
Awesome. So, do we want to jump into it?
Sure.
Today we are reading No Sleep Stories, which we used to do in our youth. So,
old times, many eons ago.
Do you want to start?
Sure.
Start us off. Awesome.
Okay, so the first story I found is posted by user Grand Theft Motto and is called Something Walks Whistling Past My House Every Night at 3:03.
Spooky.
Okay. Every night, no matter the weather, something walks down our street whistling softly. You can only hear it if you're in the living room or the kitchen when they walk by, and it always starts at exactly 3:03. The sound starts faint. Somewhere near the beginning of the lane near the Carson Place. We're towards the middle of the street, so the whistling moves past us before fading away in the direction of the cul-de-sac. When I was younger, my sister and I would sneak into the kitchen some nights to listen. Mom and Dad didn't like that, and we'd catch hell if they found us out there, but they were never too hard on us since we always stuck to the one big rule. Don't try to look at whatever was whistling.
Ooh.
I know.
Spooky.
It's a funny place. I've lived here since I was six, and I love it. The houses are small but well-kept, good-sized yards, plenty of places to roam. There are a lot of other kids here my age. I turned 13 back in October. We grew up together and would always play Foursquare in the cul-de-sac or roam around from back porch to back porch in the summer. This was a good place to grow up. I'm old enough to see it. And there's only the two strange things here, the night whistling and the good luck. The whistling never bothered me much. Like I said, I couldn't even hear it from my bedroom. But Mom and Dad don't like talking about it, so I've stopped asking questions. My dad is a strong guy, tall and calm. He has an accent.
My dad's stronger than your dad.
Want to bet?
My dad will beat your dad up.
Would he?
No.
He has an accent since he moved to the U.S. as a kid. His family, my grandparents, they're from the islands. That's what they call it. My dad, the only time he isn't so calm is if the whistler comes up. He talks to them. Eyes move faster, and he tells us not to think about it so much and to always remember the one rule, the big rule. Don't try to look outside when the whistler goes past. Not that we could even look if we wanted. There are shutters on the inside of every window, thick pieces of heavy canvas that pull down from the top and latch to the bottom of the window frame. Each latch has a small lock about the size of what you find on a diary. My dad locks those shutters every night before we all go to bed and keeps the key in his room. My mom? I don't know what she thinks about the whistling. I've seen her out in the living room before at 3:03 when the sound starts. I could see her if I cracked my door open just an inch to peek. She's not out there often, at least I haven't caught her much, but once or twice a month I think she sits out there on her big red couch just listening. The whistler has the same tune every night. It's cheerful. Da 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 dum. Da 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 dum.
Da 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 da.
Something like that.
Sounds good.
Remember how I said there are two odd things about where I live?
Well,
it's our night whistler. Everyone in my neighborhood is really lucky. It's hard to explain, and Dad doesn't like us talking about this part much either, but good things just seem to happen to people around here a lot. Usually it's small things, winning a radio contest or getting an unexpected promotion at work, or finding some arrowheads buried in the yard, you know, the authentic kind.
Ooh.
The weather is pretty good, and there's no crime, and everyone's gardens bloom extra bright in the fall. A million little blessings, I've heard my mom say about living here. But the main reason we stay here, why we moved here in the first place, is my sister Nola. She was born very sick, something with her lungs. We couldn't even bring her home when she was born, only visit her in the hospital. She was so small, I remember, small even compared to other babies. A machine had to breathe for her. We moved into her house here to be closer to the hospital. As soon as we moved here, she started getting better. The doctors couldn't figure it out. They chalked it up to whatever they were doing, but we could all tell they were confused. But my parents knew, even I knew, Nola getting better was just another of the million little blessings we got for living in our neighborhood. It's very cultish. So that's why we stayed, even after we found out that for every small miracle that happens here, every day, now and then, some bad things happen. But they only happen if you look for the Whistler.
Oh, well, don't look at the Whistler.
You know, just
solved.
I don't see it. See, our neighborhood has a welcoming committee. They show up with macaroni casserole and a gift basket and a manila folder whenever someone new moves in. They're very friendly. Four people showed up when we moved in 7 years ago. The committee made small talk, gave me stickers, and took turns holding Nola. Then the committee asked to speak to my parents in private. The welcoming committee told my parents about how nice the neighborhood was. And then they told my parents about the even harder to explain whistling that happened every morning at 3:03 and ended at the tick of 3:05. The group, our new neighbors, warned my parents that the whistling was quiet, would never harm or hurt us, and as long as we didn't look for what was making the sound.
Not to sound dumb, but like 3:03 is so late. Like, just go to bed.
You're snoozing. It's 2 minutes.
Yeah, like, sounds so easy and you get all this good luck.
No, small price, Jesus. So what if the hell demon's gentrifying your neighborhood?
Cares? You're going to win a radio contest.
Right? A sweepstakes.
The Zach and Cody sweepstakes.
Stop. This part they stressed, and I pushed my ear into the door, straining to hear them. People who went looking for the Whistler had their luck changed, sometimes tragically. A black cloud would hang over anyone that looked. Anything could go wrong. Anything that could go wrong would. The manila envelope the committee bought over contained newspaper clippings, stories about car crashes and ruined lives, public deaths and freak accidents. Not everyone dies, I heard the head of the committee tell my dad, but the life goes out of them. Even if they live, there's no light in them ever again. No presence.
Spooky.
Whistling was so bad, it just took him out. My mom, I could tell she wasn't taking it seriously. She kept asking if this was some prank they play on new neighbors. At one point, she got angry, accused the committee of trying to scare us, asked them if they were racist on account of my dad being from the islands. My dad calmed her down, told her he could tell our new neighbors were sincere and they were just trying to help us. He explained how he grew up hearing these kinds of stories from his mom and he knew there were strange things walking among us. Some were good, some were bad, but most were just different. After the committee left, Dawn went out to the hardware store, bought the blinds, the latches, and the locks, and installed them on every window. The first night in our new house, I crept out of my room at 3 a.m., only to find him awake and on the living room couch holding my sister. He held up his finger in a shush motion and patted the couch next to him. I sat and we waited. At exactly 3:03, we heard the whistling. Da-da-da-da-dum, da-da-da-dum. It came and went, just like our neighbors said. It returns each night, and we never look, and we enjoy our million little blessings every day. Nola breathes on her own. She's grown into a strong and clever girl. My dad even joined the welcoming committee. We don't get neighbors often. Why would anyone want to leave? But when a new family moves in, my dad and the committee bring them macaroni casserole, a gift basket, and the manila folder. I can always tell by the look on his face when he comes back if the family took the committee seriously or if we'd be getting new neighbors again very soon.
Oh,
it's fucked up.
Okay.
Can I say fuck on your podcast?
Yeah. You can say anything you want.
Not long ago, a family moved in directly next to us. The previous owner, Miss Maddie, passed away at age 105.
Ooh, old.
A good, long life. A spicy one. Our neighbors seemed like they'd fit in just fine. They believe the welcoming committee took my dad's advice about locking the shutters since they had a young child of their own. Whatever newspaper clippings were in that manila envelope, whatever evidence, my dad never let us see. But I imagine it must have been awfully convincing, since our neighbors got along with no issues for the first month. One night, when they had to leave town, they sent their son Holden to stay with us. He was 12, a year under me in school. I didn't know him well before that night, but as soon as his parents dropped him off after dinner, I could tell it was going to be a bad time.
Oh no. 12-year-old boys are the worst, let's be honest.
You're fighting. Do you know who was always out there whistling every night? Holden asked the moment the adults left the room. The three of us were sitting in the den, some Disney movie playing idly on the television. My sister and I exchanged a glance. We don't talk about that, I said. I think it's that weirdo that lives in the big yellow house on the corner, Holden said. Mr. Tolles? My sister asked. No way, he's super nice. Holden shrugged. Must be some psycho killer then. Nola tensed.
If it's not Mr. Tolles, it's gotta be a psycho.
We don't talk about it, I repeated. Let's go in my room and play Nintendo. We spent the next few hours playing games, eating popcorn, and watching movies. A typical sleepover, but I could see Holden getting antsy. After my parents wished us goodnight, locked the blinds, and went to bed, Holden stood up from his beanbag and walked over to where Nola and I were sitting on my bed. "Have you ever tried looking?" he asked. "It's nearly time." Like most sleepovers, we conveniently ignored any suggestion of a bedtime. I was shocked to see he was right. It was almost 3 a.m. I sighed. "We don't... See, I can't even try to look because my dad locks the blinds every night and hides the key," he continued, ignoring me. "So does our dad," said Nola. "No," replied Holden. "No, he doesn't." "You saw him do it," I said, a little sharper than I meant to sound. Holden grinned. "Your dad locks the blinds, yeah, but he doesn't hide the key. He keeps it right on his normal keychain." "So?" I asked, worried I already knew what he'd say next, because I noticed that my dad didn't bother hiding the key anymore after all these years, because he knew we took it seriously. "So, after your dad locked up, but before your parents went to bed, I went to the bathroom. And on my way, I may have peeked into their room, and I may have seen your dad's key on his chain on the nightstand, and I maybe went and borrowed the key to the blinds." Nola and I stared, and his grin only grew wider. This little shit.
He's the worst.
"You're lying," I said. Holden shrugged. "You can check if you want. Just open your parents' door and look. You'll see his keychain right there on the nightstand." "Stay here," I told both of them. "Don't move a muscle." I hurried over to my parents' room but hesitated at the door. If Holden wasn't lying, my dad would be angry. Beyond angry. I was scared thinking about it, but more scared of an open window with a whistler right outside. I opened the door barely an inch and looked in, but it was too dark to see. I walked into the room. 2 steps into the dark, I froze. The whistling started, and I could hear it clearly from my parents' room. I never realized, but they must have heard the sound every night since we moved into the house. They never told us. I don't think I could have slept through it. I stood there, listening to the whistler come closer, unsure whether I should turn on a light or call out for my dad. Soft sounds from the living room brought me back to reality.
Nola! It must be a really good whistler. It's like gotta be so loud.
Crispest sound this
He's
side
got of- a megaphone.
Holden and Nola were standing near the front door next to the window. Holden wasn't lying. I could see him fumbling with the lock on one of the blinds. I heard a click. He did have the key.
Holden.
Holden let out a quick laugh. Nola stood next to him, hunched up, afraid but maybe curious. The whistling was right outside of her house now. "I think I made a sound," called out. I can't remember. Time felt frozen. Clock, hands nailed to the face. But I found myself moving. I'm not fast. I've never been athletic. Somehow, though, I covered the space between myself and Nola in a moment. My eyes were locked on her, but I heard Holden pull the blind all the way down so it could release. I heard the snap of it start to raise, and I heard the whistling just on the other side of the window. But I had my arms around Nola, and I turned us so she was facing away from the window. At the same time, I jammed my eyes shut. The blind whipped open. The whistling stopped. I felt Nola shaking in my arms. "Don't look, okay," I told her. "Don't turn around." We were positioned so that she was facing back toward the hallway and I was facing the window. My eyes were still closed. I felt her nod into my shoulder. I reached out with the arm not holding Nola to try and touch Holden. My hand brushed against his arm. He was shaking worse than Nola.
Ooh. I see.
I asked.
Silence.
I reached past him and gingerly felt for the window, eyes still sealed shut. The glass was cold against my fingertips. Colder than it should have been for the time of year. I moved my hand up the window, searching for the string to the blind. The glass began to get warmer the further I reached, and there was a gentle hum beating back into my fingertips. I tried not to think about what might be on the side of the window. Finally, I touched the string and yanked the blind shut. I opened my eyes. In the dim light leaking out from the kitchen, I could make out Holden, pale and small, staring at the now closed window. "Holden?" I asked again. He turned toward me, and he screamed. Everything became a flurry of motion. Light sparked to life in the hall and the living room. My parents' footsteps thudded across the hardwood floor, and I didn't turn to look back at them. My eyes were glued to Holden. He was pale. He bit his lips so hard there was a thin red line of blood running down his chin, and he wet himself.
"What
happened?" my dad asked from behind me. I managed to swivel away from him and look back. He looked. I had never seen my dad scared before, but I saw it that night, in that moment, an old, ugly terror stitched on his face, a parent's fear. "Just Holden," he mouthed to me. I nodded yes. My dad let out a breath. He looked so relieved, I nearly expected him to cheer. But then he turned to Holden, and my dad's face changed. I wondered if he felt bad for feeling good that Holden was the only one that looked. He's like, get fucked, Holden. There was a knock at the door. We all froze. Holden
went. It's the whistler.
It's the whistler. Don't answer it, my mom said. She stood at the threshold of the hall. I'd always thought she was a skeptic and just humored my dad about the windows and the whistler, but that night we were all believers. I noticed that both of my parents held baseball bats they must have taken from their bedroom. Freaking batter up.
Well, they both have baseball bats? It's crazy.
The knock came again, a little louder this time.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Holy. Please don't open the door, Holden whispered. My dad walked over to him, hugged him close. We won't, my dad promised, still holding his bat. Nothing is coming in here tonight. This time, the knocking was loud enough to rattle the door. Holden screamed again, and Nola clutched her arms around my neck. My mom came over and knelt down to us, wrapping my sister and me close. Call the police, my mom, whispered to my dad. Call the police. The knocking instantly stopped. My dad looked over his shoulder at us. Do you think? He was cut off by frantic knocking that trailed off into a polite tap, tap, tap. So he goes. Something said from the other side of the door. What the fuck? The voice from outside sounded exactly like my mom, like a parrot repeating the words back to her. Police, call the police. Police. My mom pulled us closer. Police, 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 police.
Spooky.
Please stop, I heard her whisper. I don't think calling them will help, my dad said. How will we know when they're the ones at the door? The knocking came back harder than before. The door shook, then it stopped. After a long moment, I heard the knocking again, but it was coming from our back door. We all turned together toward the back door, but the knocking immediately returned to the front door. Front to back.
Oh my God.
Loud, then quiet, then loud again. Suddenly, the sound was coming from both doors at once. Big, heavy blows like a sledgehammer. Then something started rapping against all of the windows in the house. Then the walls. It was like we were living inside a drum with a dozen people trying to play at once. Or we were a turtle, and something was attempting to claw us out of our shell. Stop, Holden yelled. The knocking died. I won't tell, Holden said, staring at the door. I promise I won't tell anyone what I just saw. Just please go away. We waited for nearly a minute. Then we heard it. A soft tapping coming from the window Holden had looked through earlier. Holden started to cry, sobbing like a prisoner watching gallows being built outside their cell. Jesus.
God.
My dad held him, brushed his hair, but never lied to him, never told him things would be okay. The tapping at the window went on for the rest of the night. We huddled together in the living room for I don't know how long. Eventually, my mom tried to take us kids into the room while my dad stayed to watch the door. But the second we moved into my bedroom, the knocking came back, so loud it was impossible to ignore. I was afraid the door couldn't take it. We went back to the living room and the knocking stopped. Only the tap, tap, tap on the window remained. None of us slept that night. The tapping stopped around 7 a.m. That's about the time the sun came up. We waited another 2 hours before my dad opened the blinds from one window. He made us all go back to my parents' bedroom first. I heard him open the door, then come back in. Okay, he told us. It's done. Holden's parents came back around lunchtime. My mom and dad walked Holden over to his house, and they all went inside for quite a while. Nola and I watched from the window. She stuck to me the whole day, right at my side, sometimes holding my hand. When my parents came back, they looked grim, but wouldn't tell us what they'd said to Holden's family. It was a Sunday, so we all spent the day together, ordered pizza, and watched movies. That night, everyone slept in my room. Nola and my mom in the bed with me, my dad in a chair he pulled over. There was no knocking that night or any night since. We didn't see much of Holden or his parents for the rest of the week. But by Thursday, there was a moving truck in their driveway. Nola and I watched them packing up the whole afternoon after school. What sticks with me most is how tired Holden and his parents look. All three had the same pallor, grim mouths, and lightless eyes. Even from across the street, I could tell something was very wrong. Holden and his family were gone before sunset. I remember what the original welcoming committee said to my parents when we moved in. Not everyone who looks at the whistler dies, but even those that live have the light go out of them, and the rest of their lives are full of misfortune. a million little tragedies. I think Holden's parents must have looked, either to comfort them if they didn't believe, or share the burden if they did. I watched Nola some days, happy and young and alive, and I wonder if I'd been slower, if she'd looked out the window that night, would I have looked too, to comfort her, to share that burden? I'm glad I don't have to find out. We still live in that house, in that neighborhood. We still hear our whistler walking past every night. The blessings, the luck, the good things here are too good to leave. But we're careful. We don't have friends over to spend the night anymore, and my dad hides the key to the blinds very, very well. Not that I've gone looking. Some things you just don't need to look for. The end.
Wow. That's God.
There's an audio clip. Oh. Should I play
the whistling? Yeah, can you play it?
Yeah.
Yeah, hit it.
Oh, it's like 19 minutes long. Oh, it's like a dramatic reading. You already did that, so.
We don't need another person to do it. I'll give this 9 out of 10.
Damn.
I liked it. It was a little spooky with the knocking.
It was spooky. I skimmed it, but I didn't read it too in depth, so it'd be a little bit fun still. And I was like, ooh, okay.
All right. My turn.
Your turn.
This is called, if you ever get a chance to explore an abandoned school, whatever you do, don't feed the students.
Jesus. They are hungry. For knowledge. People.
There are some cons to being the only person who lives in walking distance of the school I teach. Every single time the alarm goes off or someone forgets to lock, I'm called in. And at times, I feel like this has become more of a custodial job than anything. It's gotten so bad, the school had a silent alarm installed years ago, and just to add insult to injury, they routed it to my phone. Of course, the head tends to call me up to make sure I'm on my way, just in case. Just have a quick little walk around, Mrs. Wares says to me over the phone. Just make sure some of the kids haven't tried breaking into the pool again. It'd be awful if something happened.
Pool in their school?
Yeah, they're bougie.
What's that like?
I don't know. Right, yeah, except it never is just a quick little walk around. There's always something to keep you lingering, some noise that needs investigating, some mess that can't be left for kids to find. In the days at school, is nothing but a shrine to the banal and mediocre. I can't read. I'm sorry. Give me a minute. I gotta put my glasses on.
Take your time.
Life is so hard when you're blind. Really like leaning into this computer trying to see the words.
Get a magnifying glass. Sherlock that shit.
Here we go. All right. Where am I? The walls are plastered with kitsch, how do you pronounce it? Kitschy?
Kitschy, I think.
Kitschy? Kitschy, yeah. GCSE art of local beaches, bronze awards in athletics, and cardboard thermometers used to count the hundreds of dollars we've raised to stave off cancer or the apocalypse.
The
apocalypse, did you know?
You know.
These bougie schools with the pools are raising money for the apocalypse. With light streaming in the halls, buzzing with running children, it's nothing but another part of the world whistling through space with fuck all to do except keep busy. But it's different in the dark, or perhaps just when it's empty. Maybe it's because I see it so alive and full of activity in the day. There's something innately unsettling about a place only recently emptied of life. Perhaps there's a lingering body heat in the air, or a scent too subtle for the conscious mind to register. Something that tells you that 1,000 eyes have looked away from this place and now it exists outside of anyone's notice but yours. You feel alone, walking those empty corridors whose walls look unusually tall and where the distance stretches away in dizzying perspective. And it always looks so much worse at night. Maybe it's the effect bright fluorescents have, but I swear it looks cleaner in the day, and come night the floors look filthy and cracked in ways that makes me wonder if this is really the elitist private school it pretends to be. I figured it out. It's a private school. But I hate it. I hate how I only notice the rot at night. Moldy tiles, cheap laminate flooring that's buckled from moisture, and the equipment that was dated in the 90s. It's such a silly thing to let the dark get to me like that. But then again, it's not all that uncommon to hear giggling or to see shadows moving in the corner of your eye. It's impossible to escape the feeling you are following something, tracing the path of a laughing child as they run from classroom to classroom. Doors will swing gently ajar just as you turn a corner. Chairs will squeak seconds before entering a room. And TVs will blare with documentaries only to switch off just before your fingers touch the button.
Only to switch to The Bachelor.
I lost my place. Oh, and for some reason, I just keep looking. I keep going from room to room, sometimes twice around, sometimes for hours. Once I sat alone in my classroom, light switched off and listening quietly as someone took a seat and the sound of a scribbling pencil filled the silence. By the time it finally stopped, the sun was rising, and the only thing left behind was a badly chewed pencil, the wood bloodied and rancid, like it's been dragged out of a septic tank. It was so late. I didn't even bother going home. I just stayed until 7. I just stayed until 7C, filed in as normal a few short hours later. I thought about leaving, but I didn't exactly exit my last school in good standing. This place doesn't seem to mind so much if I skip a lesson or two or turn up hungover. And despite my regular difficulties, there is still a monthly bonus attached to my check that I was told the other staff should not hear about. I have to figure it's from the extra work. I wonder if I'd be mad to turn this place down. I know with some certainty that if I ever told Mrs. Wares I couldn't check in on the school, I wouldn't keep my job for much longer. And I can't help but wonder if I'm the butt of some big joke. Sometimes I find myself going there even without being called. From my house, I can see the chemistry lab, which is a large glass building that's freezing in winter and scalding in the summer.
Insulation.
Yeah. It's all windows, and on a bright night, I can see people moving around in it. Sometimes there's a light, sometimes just the vague sense of a commotion. But I can't stop myself checking it out in person, walking around the very space I once spied from a quarter of a mile away, where my house backs into the football field. It's weird. I might find a broken phone, something way too old for today's kids, or a bag of old pennies, or even a few teeth scattered around the floor.
Oh, no!
One of these things is not like the other.
I'm fucking losing teeth at school.
What are they doing, I wonder? I found out from the IT teacher that every day he has to come in and restart all the computers because their screens will be frozen on shock porn.
What?
I don't know, it's weird. He didn't make a big thing of it. He just said it wasn't nice, and if he was ever ill, I'd have to do it. So I went one night, went and sat in the IT room with 15 old computers in 3 rows of 5. It's small. We're not a big school, just 500 kids. And the room doesn't catch much light where it is. So it felt more like a dungeon than my own room that's usually a clean grayish blue at night. It was pitch black in there, and once again, I turned off my light and I waited for something. I didn't know until one by one, the monitors thunked on and the internal fan started up, going from a silent burr to a frantic and unnatural whine. I felt a kind of panic, something I attribute to the surprising volume of the computers and the epileptic sight of the monitors glitchy flashing. I steadied myself, though, and waited it out until the monitors clicked from buggy displays to images of mutilated and brutalized bodies.
Ooh.
Smashed mouths with exposed teeth and cracked bone, rib cages held open by groping fingers, soft thighs shredded by broken bottles.
Bro, what?
Each image was different and riddled with pixelated artifact. After a moment, the fans died down and the monitor settled and the room was lit up from within like a Christmas tree, and I suddenly became aware that I couldn't see anything else. The bright light unsettled my eyes so much that all I could make out were the screens that floated in the abyssal darkness. Something deep within me started screaming that I wasn't alone, and my eyes darted to the space beside and behind the computers, even under the shadowy desks, but it was all impenetrable shadow. Suddenly, the images animated, and I suppressed a gasp and a shudder. each one looped at different rates, some juddering with half a second of motion, others playing out elaborate acts of violence across the silent seconds.
What the hell? Kind of. Ooh!
I don't like it.
I don't like it.
I turned my torch on. Ooh, my, we're British. I turned my torch on.
You have to change your whole reading voice now.
I can't do a British accent.
I turned my torch on.
I turned my torch on and I tried to force myself to move, but I didn't even manage to take a step. The door I entered from, the one I'd firmly closed before settling down, was open, and tar-black footprints led into the computer room and stopped by one of the computers. I shone the light down a fraction to see beneath the desk, and I found myself wondering if there had been a glimmer of motion as I moved the light, as if something had retreated from the beam. A few pale fingers? A scrape of fabric? Or the tip of someone's foot? My mind was racing, and I was paralyzed with fear. And in the end, I simply waited it out until the sun rose and the room lit up naturally. It took hours, and those hours were not silent. Whoever was in there with me was sobbing quietly, their muffled cries ebbing with the change of gore-streaked monitors. God, it's strange to say, but over time, those images didn't look so pixelated, and for the last hour, I swore I wasn't looking through a screen at all.
Oh my God.
It really was like standing around 15 windows looking into torture cells. It wasn't about clarity. There was a sense of depth you just don't get from a computer. There were hours of unbridled suffering, assaults, torture, sadism, a group of people laughing at shivering victims who was left to pick glass out of their body. The gleeful joy and the humiliation and the power of what a gun can do to the human body and its owner. It all blurred together into a moving montage, and at times, God, I hate it. I wonder how much of what I remember I actually saw. By the time I was ready to turn the monitors off, I was pale and shaking, and my face was streaked with tears. The footprints had disappeared in the light, but I couldn't bring myself to check the desk where they led. I merely thumbed the off switch on each computer before hurrying out like a child afraid of the dark. It'd be a lie to say...
Sorry, or like a reasonable adult afraid of snuff films.
Yeah, that'd be super fucking scary. It'd be a lie to say the things here make me drink. I've always had a problem, but it was different before. Yeah. I'd be prone to bad bouts of drunkenness for most of my life, but I might spend months, even years, reasonably sober. I either didn't drink or I drank a lot. It's just... that when I get, well, oh my God, it's just when I went off the deep end, I went in head first and wouldn't resurface until I was dragged kicking and screaming out of the pool. But now I drink every day. I keep a flask on me just to take the edge off. It makes things a little fuzzy, makes the kids funnier, makes the staff friendlier, makes me a better liar. I wake up in the school some nights unsure of how I got there or if I even left. Sometimes I open my eyes and I don't even know if I'm awake or asleep or alive or dead because there's just blackness. Only the cold feel of the tiles beneath my shirt and my hands let me know where I am. In the distance, a door will groan as it swings open. I might hear the shuffle of a few chairs or the barely suppressed whisper of a fleeting presence. And I lie there, ears pricked to those sounds, and I wonder if I even really hear them or if, I'm just going mad. But I wait. I wait for the sun and for my eyes to see again, and I find myself lying on the floor of my classroom with the desk piled up high around me. I find it hard to answer anything except yes to that question. Once I awoke with an old pencil case in my hand, a faded Space Jam logo on the gel plastic front.
Oh, hell yeah.
Nice. Vintage. It was coated with dust and stuffed full of long, dead felt tip pins. The weight of it in my hand stole some of the dreamlike haze away from my mind, and I grabbed my phone for a light to check where I was. I sat up in the middle of my classroom and steadied myself while I studied the strange object in my hand. It was 3 a.m. The school's distant halls buzzed with an uneasy silence, and I pulled myself up to go looking around. For what? I didn't know. But the strange case in my hand gave me an unusual sense of purpose, and I searched until I found a loose ceiling tile in the assembly hall, and the height of which is easily 30 feet. I might have been inclined to leave it, especially after I turned the light on the lights and found myself staring at the distant corners as if firm in the knowledge that I wasn't alone. And there was no giggling in the air tonight. There was no giggling in the air tonight. Nor squeaking chairs or anything else. It felt as if the school itself was holding its breath, and I dragged out the enormous stepladder used by maintenance and began my shaky ascent. God, even now I wonder how I found the courage. I'm terrified of heights, but I climbed up anyway until my fingertips could reach out and gently push the tiles further away.
This dude don't know when to quit.
I would have just left the school. I don't know why she keeps going.
Like, three different jobs away by now.
Like, I'm not going there at night. There's ghosts.
Fuck that.
But I climbed up anyway until my fingertips could reach out and gently push the tile further away. A flurry of empty crisp wrappers and crumpled paper fell out, and I clutched the stepladder with white knuckles and wide eyes as my startled reaction sent it wobbling side to side. When it finally settled back into all four legs, I breathed a sigh of relief and rapidly began descending, feeling only some mild sense of safety when my feet were back on the ground. I knew the ceiling was, was too lightweight for anyone to actually be up there, and yet I stared at the small pile of rubbish with a worrying sense of unease. The food was ancient, the paper covered with felt-tipped drawings, and I found a dried-up pen that matched the others in the pencil case. More than that, though, there was a stench that emanated from the pile that made me think of desperation and neglect. And amongst the rubbish was a plastic bag with bottles of unhealthy-looking piss.
Real quick, what smells like desperation? What is the smell of desperation?
It's the same smell as, Teen Spirit?
Stop.
Sadness. I don't know.
The stench of regret.
Desperation smells like old chip bags and bottles of unhealthy looking piss.
Crumpled cans of Natty Bow.
And ceiling tile. I don't know. And a wet rag that looked like it had been pulling toilet duty for a while. Oh my God.
Also that.
Ew. When I finally turned my attention back to my surroundings, I saw I was not alone. From the size of him, I'd say he was around 13, and he had somehow approached me without me hearing or seeing him.
Hello? So,
he's like, just a little man. Where was I? Stopping only when he was a few meters away, where he crouched low to the floor and swayed from side to side. He looked like an animal, certainly feral in a way he moved. But it wasn't his demeanor that made me cry out. It was the gaping hole where his face should have been. The skull caved in like a hollowed out egg. His remaining skin was pockmarked and lesioned, and it took me a moment to register that he was naked. He was waiting for something, though. I didn't know what. I tried to take a step towards the nearest door, but he took one too. He knew where I was, that much was clear, if I couldn't quite figure out how. I considered shining my torch straight at him, given that the faraway ceiling lights made the hole in his head pure shadow. But there was a faint impression of wriggling amidst the darkness that made my stomach churn.
No.
And I had no idea how this thing would even react to the stimulation. I'm not sure what put the connection in my head, but I eventually reached out around to my back pocket and took the pencil case out. The boy started gibbering at the sight of it, and I cringed at the realization that the wet, excited sound was coming from his cave-like skull.
Oh!
But I slid the case across the floor, he snatched it up eagerly, and immediately ran to the nearest wall, where he scaled it with the wet sound of a gecko running up glass. With one final flourish, he stuck to the ceiling and slithered behind the loose ceiling tile like a spider. After a few seconds, the tile shunted back into place, and it looked like nothing had ever happened.
My God.
I don't like that.
It's going to be in my dreams.
Some of the kids, I think, know more than they're letting on. They're not difficult kids. Most of them are quite smart. This place pumps out Oxbridge candidates like crazy, and parents pay big fees to help smooth things over when stuff goes wrong. Suicides and runaways aren't uncommon, but we're always told that it's a coincidence of pressure, ambition, social difficulties, so on, so on. So now we hand out questionnaires twice a year to ask our students about stress. The RE teacher doubles as a counselor. It says, pfft. And we have a Mental Health Awareness Day every October, but it has never sat right with me to act like the two things are related. James Kinsberg, for example, went missing a few years back. He was a rugby player who wanted to study medicine, and rumors were he could even be looking at a contract to play under 21s for a local team. He was a big, strong boy, and yet one day I found myself trying to drag him out of the pool, half conscious. In the moment, you just think, oh shit, a student's drowning. And in my head, my students are all kids, you see. But it was only after I dragged him out that I found myself wondering how the hell he'd found himself in trouble. He looked like he could wrestle an orca and win. And there he was on the floor, shivering and sputtering out of his mouth.
That's all I'm trying to be. Wrestling an orca and winning, not the shivering part.
I think we all want to wrestle an orca and win. My computer's dying. Everything's going wrong. Okay. When I looked back at the pool, there was a kind of moment of recognition. I feel like I said that wrong. I'm not sure what exactly, just a dimming of the overhead lights, a muted silence, a tiny laugh I could not place amidst the gaggle of kids who crowded around us. But I looked back at James and I wondered if he'd run into any real trouble at all, because the look in his eyes wasn't one of someone who'd nearly drowned, but instead of someone who didn't care. He made me think of myself lying there on my classroom floor in total darkness, and that was how we'd found him. It had all started with screaming and shouting, and I ran over from the bleachers where I was acting as substitute for the lesson, only to see him pale and blue, lying down at the bottom of the pool. He didn't resist when I dove in and hauled him up, but it was like he wasn't really there, like the lights were on, but nobody was home. When he went missing, I extended my rounds to include the pool. It's a huge warehouse of a room, and the water paints pretty lights on the walls, even in the dark, since the roof is mostly glass panes. But I don't like it. The bleachers, all in neat rows with scaffolding behind, and make strange shadows, and the damn filters bang every few seconds from water that churns and makes odd shapes of the tiles beneath the waves. When I first dove in to save him, I opened my eyes underwater for just a second, and I got the strangest sense something hideous was nearby. But the pool wasn't empty, and it could have been anything, but a few times in the night, I have seen something slithering out of sight as I walked around the water's edge. It isn't human, I think, although I have, on occasion, seen the faceless boy standing at the bottom of the water with eerie stillness. But I don't think it was him that James saw. I think it was something else, something that looks like a mass of hair drifting in the current, something that effortlessly pushes itself from shadow to shadow, something that occasionally slaps its way into dry land and watches me from behind the bleachers as I check the perimeter.
He's so casual about all this. Leave. Yeah.
It just slaps itself on dry land.
This is an OSHA violation. What kind of workplace?
She gets a bonus, so it's fine. I don't know where it lives. God knows it can't be in the water all the time. But when I confronted James and asked him what he saw, he told me only that it wasn't going to leave him alone. Not now, not ever. And a few weeks later, he went missing while out for a jog along the beach. When they found him, he'd been hollowed out and stuffed into a storm drain like an inside-out gym sock.
Oh, these descriptors are colorful.
I hate it.
Yikes.
It'll eat you, he said, but that was all he ever offered me. We all acted like he committed suicide from the pressure, even as the rumors filled the school.
Oh, he just melon balled himself from the inside. What?
I don't like that.
Sorry.
How could the two things possibly be linked? I saw the photos of what happened to him. Even the police said it'd be treated as a murder. It was almost like the school knew the part it played in his death. So we all played along with the facade that he was just another promising kid lost to the difficulties of adolescence. But he knew clearly what was going to happen to him. I saw that much in his eyes. That's why he laid there on the floor. That's why he wanted to drown. that thing in the pool had tagged him, and he laid down right there and then ready to be eaten rather than go another second. Something about the sight of it just overrode every instinct inside of him, and he lay down ready, no desperate to die. Is that why I lie down too? Why I wake up on the floor of my classroom? Why I shudder into the lucidity at 3 a.m., sleepwalking from room to room? Why I waited to die, to be eaten by the building itself? I teach lessons in the silence, sometimes deliberately, sometimes in my sleep. I teach about history, but no one else, just my own. I write out episodes of my life on the blackboard like the study of the tutors or stewards, assigning homework and asking questions and even chastising the silent ghostly whispers in the back of the nocturnal classroom. To what extent was my alcoholism a consequence of modeling my mother's behavior?
That's a curveball.
Great question. I think this is things she writes on the board. It's in italics.
Oh, okay. I was like, were we supposed to know that?
Compare and contrast the loss of my father with the loss of my wife. Oh, is this a man? Sorry.
Gay people exist. Okay.
I know, but it's just my assumption that maybe it's a guy.
It could be whatever we want it to be.
Were the negative effects accumulated, or did they interact in unforeseen ways? How has age altered my politics? Compare and contrast my voting habits as a young adult with those of the last election cycle. You know, these are interesting topics.
We will be quizzed. Take notes.
One day I came into the darkness, half remembering a lesson on the role music played in my adolescent identity, and instead of continuing, I asked an instinctual question that surprised even myself. Why do I do this? I said, my voice unnaturally loud and clear in the silence. One by one, the shadowy chairs scraped back as the unseen students rose, and ghostly footsteps filled the room as they filed out. Lesson over, I muttered as I... Imagine just going there teaching some ghost kids.
Everyone deserves an education.
I muttered as I was filled with a deep, despairing loneliness that made me realize just how brittle the truly is. That's what it says. Lately, I've started getting things mixed up. I teach the wrong lessons to the wrong students. A few reports have gone in about my behavior. It's not always guaranteed that I'll wake up to find darkness all around me. Instead, there have been times I've woken up to a crowd of kids giggling at finding me asleep on the floor with the sun out bright and strong. It'd be one thing if Mrs. Ware's dragged me in to give me a bullocking when this happened, but she just asked me if I'm doing okay, if I'm fine, if I'm home, if my home life is trying. She looks at me with pity and it breaks my heart. I wish she'd be angry instead, because the more she coos, the more she calls me to check in on the place at night, the more I feel like the center of a cruel joke. Sometimes I visit the playground from when this place taught under 12s. It must have been a long time ago, because now it's just a giant pile of collapsed metal pipework, and thanks to a hole in the nearby fence that has made it a popular place to fly tip. What's fly tip?
I don't know.
Do drugs? This British lingo. All kinds of rubbish. It's isolated from the rest of the grounds by a short hedge and a weak fence, but the kids know about it anyway and sometimes go there to smoke, although not often. I like to look at it from my house. It's so ugly and brutalist. It looks like the kind of sculpture. It looks like the kind of sculpture you'll find at the Tate, with a placard mentioning things like late stage capitalism or the inevitability of death. Whatever it is, I watch it and I listen to it.
Stuff.
You know, modern art. I watch it and I listen to it and occasionally visit it in person. I swear the pile changes, sometimes even just between blinks of the eye. I pulled out bloody axes and bike chains, pointed knives with clumps of hair and matted gore along the edge, tricycles smashed to pieces with bits of headlight in the spokes, all these things that make me feel queasy in the stomach. Supposedly, the pile eats pets, which is a rumor that works wonders for keeping kids away in the day, but has only piqued my curiosity. Sorry, I can't read.
Take your time. You're Thanks. Doing good.
Thanks, Mom. I have pulled out my fair share of crumpled pelts and torn collars, but for some reason, I'm not sure they come from things around here. I have nightmares about climbing down between the endless beams of rusted, jagged metal and climbing on forever and ever with no stop. It's an unspoken certainty, a belief held within my chest, that I don't think the pile rests on asphalt at all. I think it doesn't stop. I think it gathers things of loss and regret and guilt, just like everywhere else in this school. Are there blackboards in the day? I stopped not long ago and held a dry erase marker in my hand, stumped by the most unbelievable thought. When I teach at night, I use chalk. I have even gone home and washed my clothes to clear them of the dust. But how, then, do I come in and teach to the class using a whiteboard? My memories are becoming fuzzier with time, perhaps because of the drink, perhaps not. Sometimes I think back to my experience in the computer lab and my fingers pushing a heavy button of a clunky CRT monitor. Sometimes I simply depress the dainty touchscreen buttons of the modern LCD. Which one was it exactly? Could it be both? Might it have happened more than once? I'm not sure it's the same school come night, and in fact, it feels worse as time wears on. There's an acceleration happening behind the scenes, just out of sight. Sometimes I visit the halls, and half the tiles have fallen down, and the faceless boy looks sad as he perches along the vents and the wiring. Sometimes the pool has grown thick with algae, and the tiles have decayed, and the window panes along the roof have been smashed to pieces. And the only hint of the aquatic inhabitants is the disturbance of the grotesque pond scum as it tracks my movements from edge to edge, grotty trainers and children's shoes and human hair rising to the surface as the water churns. But was it always like that? Do I have a memory of pulling James out of the sewage-riddled pool, pushing through the thick green water as I dove in to drag him up? When did I even see the photo of him stuffed into a storm drain? And yet I remember it so clearly. He was a good kid, I think. Sometimes he's there amid the faces that surround me when I wake up in the middle of the day to bright lights and laughter. Sometimes he asks questions as I talk about my experiences growing up. His hand raises as he asks if 3 weeks with mono will appear in the final exam. Sorry. That doesn't make sense, but I don't question it. It's my duty to educate after all, and I think he needs it where he is. I hate this place, but I can't leave it alone. I feel hollowed out most days. I'm forgetting things a little too important, things I don't want to let go of without a fight. But every time I speak to Mrs. Wares, I lose all sense of time and just find myself agreeing to everything she says. Have I met her in person? Am I sure I have? She's spoken to me in her office, but is that the same as seeing her in person? I can't say. I must have interviewed for this position, right? I must have remembered asking her about lunch, about the canteen. And she gave the funniest answer. Oh, don't worry about that. No one here needs a canteen, but they might just gobble you right up. I feel like canteen's a word I don't understand.
Like cafeteria.
Oh, okay. Got it. Did I laugh at the time or leave? I think I stormed out of her office after she said something I didn't like. Something about my wife, maybe. Except, well, after storming out, I went straight back to work in my classroom, which is always just a few doors down from her office, which now that I think about, that just doesn't seem right. But then again, my name has always been on the faculty list. I've read it there multiple times, but like I said, my memory grows fuzzier with time. Things change. The school has changed, I think. But I can never revisit the past, can I? Only what I remember of it. I remember it one way, but sometimes I stand in the silence, in the pitch black nothingness of the moonless night, and I wonder if it has always been exactly as it is now. Change is so hard to keep track of. Why is it that when I awake on the floor, my clothes have gotten bigger?
What?
I don't know. I must be so very old. Was I as old as I am a few years ago? Of course not. That's a stupid question. It's just sometimes I walk around here and I feel like an octogenarian, which doesn't quite sit right in my mind. Should I be, what, mid-40s? Or is that a meaningless question to a drunk? Still, I keep going. I keep teaching. Although lately, it feels like I teach more at night than at day. Sometimes I think even Sometimes I've never even seen the sunrise. It just keeps going, one long episode without end. I hope to take a break soon, to retire. God knows I need it. I just need to clear my head, to get it all down in one place, to think clearly, if only for just a few minutes. But after writing it all down, I feel only more confused than I did before. My most recent question for the students, written in chalk on a blackboard illuminated only by moonlight, leaves me feeling empty and alone. I don't like it. What is eating my mind? The end.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
So it's like the school was never really a school. It's just an eldritch horror wearing a thin disguise. Maybe.
Yeah. I think like the school is fucking with this person, this teacher. Mm-hmm. She went there and like she was like, oh, I got calling at night, but then as more time went on, she just gets older and she can't remember anything. And it's eating her. It's eating her consciousness.
Right. And then she started to doubt her recollections of students at all. Or like, did I ever actually speak
to
my boss?
Did I ever meet the teacher? Or,
like, was I just here the whole time? Like, what?
Why are there whiteboards at night and whiteboards in the day? Why are there old computers at night? She's like used to the ghost now.
So wild.
Yeah, that was good. It was better than I thought it would be.
That was very surrealist.
Yeah, I like that.
Very Lovecraftian, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so I had picked out this plane-related one, but what I didn't notice is it's like seven-parter, so I swapped it for another plane-related one that's pretty short and sweet.
Nice.
It's called, I volunteered to sit next to a dead man on a plane and deeply regret it. Posted by user Dies in Darkness.
Ooh.
The man in seat 43A died halfway across the Atlantic. I was sitting near the front of the plane, just behind first class, and couldn't really see the commotion, but I could hear someone gasping and retching, loud at first, then quieter and quieter. A flight attendant got on the PA and asked for any medical professionals among the passengers to help. I guess there were none. After a few minutes, the man's sounds deteriorated into a sort of gurgle, then silence. Then it was over. His name was Molyneux, and he was old, but not that old. And it was likely a heart attack, aneurysm, drug reaction, or God's will, according to conflicting nth hand reports that filtered down the plane from row 43, where flight attendants simply buckled the newly deceased back into his window seat and covered his face with a complimentary airline blanket.
I mean, I guess that's like how they would do it if you can't land the plane.
I guess. The pilot got on the intercom and told us the plane would be turning back to Newark due to a tragic medical situation involving one of our passengers. Folks were looking for a volunteer willing to sit next to the deceased while we returned to our originating airport, the pilot continued. This flight is entirely full, and the person sitting there now isn't feeling comfortable. It's an aisle seat, and it will only be a few hours before we're back over land. I'm not sure why I volunteered. Probably some combination of exhaustion, altruism, and morbid curiosity. My vacation plans were shot anyway, I figured, so why not take the most interesting seat on the plane? The flight attendant thanked me profusely, as did a queasy-looking teenager who took my original seat. I picked up my handbag and shuffled down the aisle to the very last row of the plane. My only prior experience with corpses was an open casket funeral for my grandmother when I was a kid. But the idea of death had never particularly bothered me. It's natural, after all. That said, I admit that I second-guessed my decision as soon as I saw my new seatmate. Mr. Molyneux, rest in peace, sat upright between the window and me, strapped around the waist with a blue fleece blanket covering his torso and head. The blanket didn't cover his hands, which were resting on his lap above a seatbelt, placed that way by a flight attendant as a sign of respect, I assumed. Molyneux's pale fingers were twisted into claws that betrayed the agony of his death. I couldn't look at those hands without imagining what his face looked like under the blanket. I thought of asking for a second blanket, but the flight crew was still busy calming down other passengers and preparing for a U-turn around the Atlantic Ocean. So I tried to forget my uneasiness and closed my eyes and slept. I woke hours or minutes later, I don't know, to the jostling of turbulence. The cabin lights were off, and most of the passengers around me seemed to be sleeping. I looked out the window, trying not to look at Molyneux as I did so, and saw only the uniform blackness of the night. I imagined the ocean miles below us, lightless and cold. The thought unsettled me, and I reached across Molyneux to close the window shade. Then I stopped myself. Hadn't the shade been closed when I sat down? I realized there was something else off about the scene. Molyneux's posture had somehow changed while I slept. It took me a few seconds to pinpoint it. His gnarled hands remained on his lap. He was still belted at the waist, and the blanket still shrouded his upper body, but the fabric looked somehow twisted now, as if he had been fidgeting. Very slowly, knowing it was insane, even as I knew I couldn't stop myself, I lifted a corner of the blanket.
Why would you do that? Girl,
don't look. I uncovered his shirt, which the flight crew had unbuttoned while trying to save him. A patch of blue-gray skin sprouting white chest hair peeked out from it. I lifted the blanket higher. His collar was flecked with dried blood. I remembered his terrible gasping. Finally, I pulled the blanket entirely off and stifled a scream. Molyneux's head was turned away from me, exactly as if he had turned to stare out the window. I could see his face reflected in the plexiglass. It was undoubtedly a dead man's face, pale, drawn, lips parted, jaw slack. There was no life in it. Except his eyes. They were moving. I stared at the reflection for half a minute, and I'm sure of it. In the center of that death mask, two pupils flicked back and forth, as if tracking something out there in the sky. "What are you doing?" a voice beside me interrupted. I whipped around and saw the woman seated across the aisle staring at me, not so much in fear as disgust. "Cover him back up. Give him his peace."
I think he's been moving," I stammered. "His eyes. I think he might not actually be," but I couldn't finish the sentence. It was too crazy. Nor did I have to, because at that moment, my stomach dropped 10 feet along with everything else in the plane.
Yep. Woo! Coffee cups and purses slammed against the ceiling. A man near the first class section nearly tumbled out of a seat. I heard call lights going off all over the plane as passengers were jolted awake in panic and confusion. "Passengers, please take your seats, buckle in, and secure any loose items," the pilot said over the PA, sounding shaken himself. "The weather along our flight path is clear, and no planes in the area are reporting turbulence, so I'm not sure what this is, but we should be through it momentarily." Even as he spoke, the mild background shaking I'd felt since waking up became noticeably more violent. The woman across the aisle began fumbling for her seatbelt, no longer paying attention to me or Molyneux. I forced myself to look at him again. The jolt must have caused him to pitch forward at the waist, his head colliding with the seat in front of him.
Yeah.
But Molyneux's face was still turned toward the window, his neck twisted at such a sharp angle that I was worried it had snapped. I lifted his hands again and the pallor of his skin. Three flight attendants and a dozen passengers had witnessed this man's death, and I could not rationally imagine they were mistaken. Yet, in the reflection of the window, his eyes left to right, left to right. I had heard that strange reflexes sometimes kick in after death. Limbs flailing, headless chickens running, nerves clearing out the last backlog of instructions from the brain. But the eyes? I had never heard of that. I made myself look past that unsettling reflection, at the sky itself. It was still dark, moonless, and cloudless, but the atmosphere seemed to have taken on a strange hue. A very dark green, like pea soup fog.
Pea soup fog?
I thought I could see vague shapes swirling around in the murk, though it might have been an optical illusion. I recoiled. I desperately wanted to be anywhere else right then, but the rest of the cabin was approaching a state of pandemonium. Flight attendants were hurrying up and down the aisles, attending to spills and bruises even as they tripped and staggered. The entire plane was shuddering like a barrel going down the rapids. A series of jolts sent Molyneux's upper body swinging back and forth like an upside-down pendulum. He was thrown backward into a seat, then sideways into me, a horrible feeling I'll never forget. Then the opposite way, his face slamming directly into the window where it came to rest. That was enough for me. I unbuckled, leapt out of my seat, and locked myself in the back bathroom directly behind me. I would cower on a toilet for the rest of this hellish flight rather than spend another minute sitting with Mr. Molyneux. This plan worked for a half hour or so. I braced both my arms against the bathroom's walls and listened to the chimes of flight attendant call buttons, the whine of jet engines, and the growling of the sky. I tried to calm myself by visualizing the skyline of New York, the JFK airstrip, and a calm descent. But then I imagined Molyneux's window, his face mashed up against the glass like a little boy's, his dead eyes searching the night. The captain's disembodied voice called me back to reality. He sounded outright scared now, and the PA kept cutting in and out.
extremely anomalous weather, need everyone in their seats in the emergency position immediately. If we depressurize, the turbulence stopped for 4 or 5 seconds, and then suddenly it felt like I was inside a washing machine. I bounced against the walls of the bathroom, landed on the floor, and could barely manage to get the door open and crawl on all fours into the aisle.
I can just imagine them, like, just going around the bathroom.
Around and around and around. All three flight attendants were down, sprawled on backs and bellies between the seats. Some of the overhead luggage bins had burst open and spewed baggage out. Many of the passengers were weeping. A few prayed, and through it all, the plane would not stop shaking. I heard a series of small bangs above my head and felt something wet on my cheek. Every single soda can in the galley had exploded. Not the Sprite.
The ginger ale.
I climbed into my seat and belted myself in, having briefly forgotten about Molyneux in my terror. Thwack! Thwack! But he was still in his seat, of course, whipping back and forth like a flagpole in a hurricane, head butting the window so hard that I could see the plexiglass balloon outwards and rebound each time. Thwack! I became worried he'd crack the window, though that's supposed to be impossible, so I overcame my revulsion and grabbed his shoulders. But I couldn't restrain him. Again and again, his head hit the window. I began to fear that it was not simply the motion of the plane that compelled him. Thwack! 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 No one else on the plane was watching this. Some of the passengers had rallied and were trying to pull the injured flight attendants out of the aisle. Others were whispering goodbye messages into their phones. Thwack! Thwack! The sound effect. I heard something crack beside me and hoped desperately that it was Molyneux's skull and not the window. Outside, I could see that the green fog was alive with swirling amorphous shapes. Thwack.
Oh, God.
And it's like phonetic spelling of explosions. Another explosion, not pop cans this time, but pressurized oxygen escaping into the sky. Molyneux had managed to smash out both window panes in one final blow. Now his mangled head was hanging outside the plane, and the rest of his body was straining to follow it, restrained only by his seatbelt and the width of his shoulders. An alarm went off in the cabin, and a jungle of oxygen masks fell from the ceiling. I put mine on at once, but heard other people screaming. Some passengers were desperately trying to get masks on the unconscious air crew. But the plane was shaking more violently than ever, and loose debris was flying up the aisle toward my row, toward the hole a dead man had made in the airplane. Cabin breached, said the pilot. Limited backup oxygen, so I'm trying to descend to a safe altitude. But hard to do that in the storm or whatever it is. God be with us. Once I was sure that I could breathe and was in no danger of being sucked out myself, I took one last look at Molyneux. His head might have torn clean off outside the window, for all I could see of it past the rest of his body. You good, Maggie?
His whole head just ripped off.
I pictured those eyes again, which had seen something in the sky that we had not seen, could not see, even as it now threatened to shake the plane apart. There was some connection between these events that I might never understand, but even without understanding, I could make the last move available to me. I reached over Molyneux's lap, lifted one of those cold, clawed hands, and unclasped his seatbelt. Liberate him.
Shove him out the window.
There was an intolerable crunching noise, as I presume his shoulders were squeezed and crushed to fit the window frame. And then in a split second, he was gone, out the window, into the night, a pale old man falling end over end toward the black ocean.
Dear God.
Whatever you saw out there, I whispered, whatever you were looking for, go to it and leave us be.
Be free.
Fly free, Molyneux. The green fog lifted a few minutes later, and the plane descended until it was safe to breathe without the masks. Less than an hour later...
Isn't the window still crashed?
Yeah. Doesn't make sense. Less than an hour later, I really did see the JFK airstrip. A whole squadron of police and ambulances met us on the way down. The flight attendants and several passengers had to be hospitalized, but as far as I know, no one suffered serious injuries. Federal investigators eventually concluded that we had flown through a localized weather anomaly, witnessed by no other plane in the sky that night. Some sort of debris must have been flying around up there with us and taken out the window at 43A, they wrote in the report. This event led to a sudden loss of cabin pressure, in which the body of a passenger who had died earlier in an unrelated medical emergency was ejected from the plane. I expected to hear a lot more about it on the news, but I suppose in the end it was just one of those things. The airline had no interest in publicizing the incident, of course, and the passengers had no desire to relive it. For most people on the flight, it was simply a freak tragedy followed by a close call, and all's well that ends well. I'm the only one that will dream for the rest of my life about Molyneux's eyes and what they saw on the way to the ocean. The end.
Wow.
Holy Jeez. Crap.
I feel like some of that wouldn't Delta happen Airlines. On the plans.
Life is a life fucking is a nightmare.
Some of that wouldn't happen on a plane.
One would suspect.
One would assume that a dead man's head couldn't break a window, but...
Yeah, stranger we don't know. Things, I get. Molyneux we'll would argue differently. Sometimes when you gotta go, you gotta go.
Oh my god. Alright, so my turn. Every time I say my turn, I think it's a song, and someone's just like, my turn, and then they start rapping, and I can't remember. It's not okay. So this.
What are you bringing us home with?
So I had the New York one, but that one got deleted. So now I have one that was posted 3 hours ago, and it's called, I moved into 323 Waterview Place last Wednesday, middle finger raised. Now it's Sunday, and I regret ignoring my neighbor's warnings.
Okay.
I think this is really short.
Up and ready to go.
But my name's in it, so.
Ooh.
I was like, might as well.
Hopefully that's not a bad omen.
Nothing could stop me from moving into 323 Waterview Place. Not even God. The end. No. For this reason, when my neighbors warned me about the terrors that resided within, namely the bleeding wallpaper and the faceless woman, I told them the fuck right off, please and thank you. I promised my wife, Maggie, that I would buy her a house by the sea, no matter how much it costs.
I'm the narrator.
I just want a house by the sea.
Anything for you, darling.
If only I could have fulfilled this promise before Maggie passed away last summer.
Oh shit.
Dad.
I take it back.
That's so rude. She dies and you're like, well, now I will buy a house by the sea.
Well, have fun without you.
Regardless, fulfilling my promise late was better than letting my words follow her into the ground. I was right. I moved in the day after my check cleared the bank. My neighbors watched me from their windows as I directed the movers, faces paler than ivory. I relished their concern. Sorry. Their disdain for my decision to ignore their warnings was palpable in the air. It clogged my throat, reminded me of my time spent in the humid jungles of Vietnam.
Whoa.
I flipped them off every time I passed through the front door.
Rude.
When I heard Maggie's voice drifting from the bathroom later that night, I shot up in bed so quickly my spine cracked. That's rough. Although the voice had just been above a whisper, it was unmistakably hers. So I lowered myself to the floor, slid into my slippers, and trundled towards the bathroom door, doing my best to ignore my palpitating heart. Maggie's voice sounded again the moment I placed my hand on the doorknob. This time, she was humming. Hmm. That's the sound of a hum. I paused, relishing the sound. Maggie had been a professional jazz singer in her 20s. Yes, I have. Ooh. Memories of her twirling around on stage flooded my mind. Tears filled my eyes. I opened the door. Shadows consumed the room. To my right, I could make out the loose silhouette of a bathtub, and to my left, a tricep. Oh, sorry. I don't know why I said tricep. A decrepit toilet. The previous owner had taped a note to the toilet lid. I picked up this note and I strained my eyes against the blackness. Be weary of buying this house. The faceless woman stalks its halls. She spends most of her time in this bathroom, moaning and filling the shower with blood. Although her purpose here is unclear, she makes one point distinct. She wants the house to herself. She will do anything to drive you from this house, including killing your pets. Oh, God. But the moment we moved here, she has made our lives miserable wrecks. I can hardly sleep due to her incessant shrieks. Her actions are growing bolder by the hour. Yesterday, I felt her hand upon my shoulders while I was in the shower. She nearly frightened me to death. I cannot live in this place a moment longer. My wife would be furious if she heard me say this, but I have to warn you, this house is dangerous. Do not buy it.
Oof.
I placed the note back on the toilet. It was then I noticed a fetid stench drifting from the shower. I had been so consumed by the humming that my mind hadn't registered it yet. I walked over to the shower and pulled back the curtain. The following message was written on the wall in blood. It took me many months to drive out the last couple that lived here. Welcome home, John. I've missed you.
Oh, Jesus. Maggie. What?
That's it. That's the end of it.
They got their house by the sea.
Aww. That's so romantic.
That's cute.
Modern love.
That's love.
That's love. That's it. Thank you.
What a show.
What a cute little short story about love.
I'm here for it. That's what I want.
Just you and your ghost wife living together in a house by the sea. All right.
All right.
All right. Which one was the best? What's your opinion?
That's hard. Man, that's super hard. I really liked the kind of surreal, like, eldritch horror style of the school one. But I think the opening one with the whistler had a great pacing and buildup, and I got, like, chills just while reading it, which is, like, pretty big. But then it's, like, the plain one. I do love gothic imagery of, like, green swirling fog and black oceans and bodies flailing around on their own. And then I'm like, ghost wives. So, like, I don't know. Can I pick all of the above?
Yes, they're perfect. They're all great in their own nice little way. I like the school one. I think it would be fun. I think there's a lot of visuals.
Yeah, there were some really good visuals.
If there's one thing about meaty
nastiness.
If there's one thing about No Sleep Stories, it's they really know how to run a metaphor, so
They really ought to know how to make your stomach flip.
Ugh. His body was like an inside out sock. All right, thank you for being on my podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor.
I love you. You're amazing.
You're even you. Better. Miss you too. Stop. Warn me next time. You can get all mushy on me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you to our listeners for still being here and listening to us. I hope everyone is safe and healthy, and I hope no one's killing anyone. So that's ideal.
Yeah, don't give Maggie more true crime to report on, folks.
No, I don't want that. All right, thank you for listening. Goodbye, everyone. Bye.
Bye.